Good evening. This is lecture two of Principles of Grammar. And I want to begin by making more clearly one point that I rushed in at the very end last time. So if you turn to the Principles of Grammar lecture one that we looked at last time, number 13. We were there giving examples of clauses used as different parts of speech. And I underscored the main clause. The main clause, of course, being that clause which stands by itself, which expresses the essence of the thought, and the other types of clause are simply like an adjective, an adverb, or a single noun within the main clause. Now, I want to point out the third example under 13, what he will decide is important. As the main clause, I have underscored only is important. That is obviously not a clause. Why not? Because it doesn't have a subject. It just has a predicate. So we would have to analyze this in order to make clear the full main clause. And the proper analysis would come in breaking up the word what. The word what in this kind of construction is actually a compound. It means that which or the thing which. In other words, it means the thing which he will decide is important. In which case, then, if we use that type of analysis, what will the main clause be? Suppose we take what as meaning the thing which. What will then be the main clause in the statement, the thing which he will decide is important? What will be the main clause? Yes. The thing is important. Correct. And which he will decide is then simply an adjective clause modifying thing, telling you what type of thing. Now, in any case such as this, where you have a noun clause as subject or object, you may have to resort to some type of analysis to get out the full main clause and separate it from the modifiers. But if you understand that, there's no problem. I just didn't want anyone to be confused by the fact that I've underscored only a predicate as though that could be a clause. And by the same token, in she knows what he will decide, the real main clause is she knows the thing. And then the subordinate is which he will decide. That's if you want to break up the full main clause. All right, now let us turn to the homework from last time. Normally, we will be taking new theory at the beginning of each class and the homework at the end when you're more tired. But in this particular case, we must start with the homework because you have to be familiar with the concepts and terminology we introduced last time to be able to go on. So in this one case, we have to try to automatize this terminology by taking up the homework first. And as you'll see, I'm going to be interspersing some new theory with the homework. We won't always have this neat division of all the theory first and all the exercises. Sometimes it's easier to take up theoretical points of a lesser dimension in connection with the homework. All right, with that understanding, let us turn to number one. This is the homework for lecture one, and it says parse the following. And parse essentially means analyze the grammatical structure of. And that involves telling us what's the subject, what's the predicate, what's the complement, if any. In other words, giving the structure of the sentence, the main parts of the sentence. And then, on another level, it means telling us, are these parts made up of phrases or clauses? How many clauses? What kinds of clauses? And then on still another level, it means focusing on each word and saying what part of speech is it that's performing this function. Is the subject, for instance, a noun or a pronoun? Is the complement an adjective? If there's a clause, does it function as an adjective or a verb, etc.? So you have to give us the parts of the sentence, the parts of speech, and the structure, whether it is a word, a phrase, a clause, how many clauses. All right, let us do number one, which is a simple example. First of all, how many clauses in the part prior to the period? Raise your hand if you know how many clauses. I think we even did this last time. Yes. Two clauses. What are the two clauses?
When Jack came into the room.
Is one. When Jack came into the room. And next, now speak up. Yeah?
The second is he began to remove his coat.
Right. He began to remove his coat. Which is the main clause? The main clause is the one which stands by itself. Yes. He began to remove his coat. That's the thrust of the sentence. What is the type of clause then? Is the first one. Now somebody else. Just raise your hand if you know. What type of clause? Kathy? Well, yes, we haven't introduced the word subordinate yet, but it is an adverbial clause. It's a clause that functions as an adverb. Why? It tells the condition under which you began, in this case, the time. And anything which tells you the time of an action is an adverb. Let's break that up then. We've got two clauses. Okay. What part of speech is when? Now, we want to do this with a certain alacrity so as not to kill the whole night. Yes. It's a conjunction. Why? Because it conjoins or unites the two clauses. And this happens to be a special type of conjunction because it's a temporal word functioning as a conjunction, and therefore it is an adverbial conjunction, an adverb for functioning as a conjunction. Okay, let's go. What is the next part of speech? Jack?
Proper noun.
It's a noun. Well, we didn't go into proper or common. You brought that in, but correct, it's a noun. What's the verb in the first clause? Yes, came. What type of construction is into the room? It's a prepositional phrase. Functioning in this case as what part of speech? An adverb. Why? Came, telling you where Jack went. All right, now let's just take the subject predicate of that first clause. What's the subject? Meaning the simple subject. The one word which carries the subject of that clause. Yes?
Jack.
Jack. What is the predicate, the simple predicate, the word which indicates the action?
Came.
Now, how many are attempted to call into the room the complement of that clause? Well, that's fine if you're not, because it is not the complement. The complement is not defined as anything which comes after the verb. It's not any miscellaneous verbiage. It's whatever is required to complete the essence of the construction. And in this case, nothing is required. Jack came is the essence of the idea. Into the room is just a modifier of came. A complement has to be something, for instance, like a noun, which functions as the object of the verb. Jack hit what? The boy. Or Jack is what? Sick. Basically, a complement has to be a noun or an adjective. An adverbial phrase is simply a modifier of the verb and is not a complement. So in this case, we just have Jack came as the subject and predicate. All right. What is the subject of the main clause? We have to...
He.
Correct. Just call it out. Right. What is the predicate of the main clause? The simple predicate. Be careful. Began. Correct. Well, what do we do with to remove? Is that not part of the verb then? No, what is it then? What type of construction? It's a phrase, obviously. It's two words, but what type of phrase? Yes?
The noun phrase.
Well, it's functioning as a noun, but you still didn't tell me what...
prepositional phrase.
No, it's not a prepositional phrase.
It's
an infinitive. It's an infinitive, right. It tells, and in this case, it's what in relation to began. Tells you what he began, so it's the object. I didn't yet introduce direct versus indirect object, I just said object. It's what he began. Whenever something tells you what the verb did, what he began, that's the object. And now, in this case, the object has an object. What is the object of the infinitive? To remove what? Coat is the noun, which is the object, and what part of speech is his? An adjective, saying what kind of coat. All right, we've done about as much as we have to for this one. Now, what do you do with, let us just ask one question. What is the complement of the main clause? In this case, we have a complement because we have something essential to completing the structure of the thought. Yes. To remove his coat is the complement. That completes it. It tells you what he did, what he began. All right. Now, what do we do with a wise move? What is the subject of that statement, or that three-word unit? What is the subject of it? Yes. There is no subject. That's all I need to know. What is the predicate? There is no predicate. Is this then a sentence? No. What is this called? A fragment. Now, I want to take this brief moment to interject a word about fragments. What we have here is considered bad stylistic. This is a fragment masquerading as a sentence. This is, in other words, something which is merely a part of a sentence, but with the capital first word and the period at the end acting as though it's a sentence. Now, the general principle with regard to fragments are they should be used only rarely. I would not say never, even though technically they are not sentences and they violate the principles of grammar. They do, however, if used rarely, have a certain value. And the value is basically an issue of emphasis. There is a weight, a stress associated with a period, with a full stop, that you can't really get in any other way. That's the dignity of a whole unit addressed to your reader, and you're telling him, take this in as one unit. When you want that for your fragment, and you're not overdoing it, you can get an emphasis for those words, a wise move, which you can't get in any other way. If you said he began to remove his coat, dash, a wise move, it doesn't have the same weight as a complete stop. Now this can only be done, this kind of added stress, this slowing down, you see, by making the reader stop before and after it, only when the full thought is so clear that the rest of the sentence is implicit, and therefore you don't need to give the statement. Now in this case, a wise move, what is the implicit rest of the statement? No, I want a full sentence, a subject and predicate that is implicit in here but not stated. Yes. It was, or this was, a wise move. So here it's pretty clear, but it's bad in this case because there's no reason in the world to give that kind of enormous stress to a minor comment, such as a wise move. This happens frequently, and it's okay. You can write something and say, so far, so good, with a capital S and a period. Now that's a fragment. You may want it in a context of stressing. See, you're stopping completely to give the weight of a full sentence just to that fragment. And what you're really saying is, what we have done so far is so good, but you drop out the subject and the predicate and just leave it to implication. Now if you look at lecture two that you have, the examples. Number one, you will see there what the use of a fragment can accomplish. Here is the exact same words. He thought as much as he observed. More, in fact. The first stated simply as one sentence. The second stated with a period and a separate fragment. He thought as much as he observed. More, in fact. Now you see, I think, that the first one, you race right through the more, in fact. And it just is one element of a sentence. It does not have anything like the stress and the slowed down quality that he thought as much as he observed. More, in fact. So a fragment is legitimate if it is used rarely for purposes of special emphasis. It can, however, be very badly overdone. And I caution you against that. Now I want to quote you a passage that I got from Fowler. This is an excellent book. I don't recommend you just sit down and read it because it's sort of like a dictionary of usage, but it's by a very brilliant, erudite, witty, old-fashioned Britisher of the kind that don't exist anymore. A Dictionary of Modern English Usage by H.W. Fowler, from which I will be occasionally quoting or giving examples. And he has an excellent discussion of overdoing the use of fragments, and he gives this example from a real author. Now, I'm going to read it to you. Wherever I pause is where the author had a period and then a capital letter, describing some town. Quote, "It is an entire street full of shops, complete with side arcades, and a restaurant, and two snack bars, all piled on top of one another. A whole civilization all by itself. Practically a state, period." In other words, it's just a whole series of fragments. And this is an inept attempt, you see, to give some emphasis which the person can't get by the structure and the content. So just piling fragments. And it gives you that breathless, artificial, mannered prose, which is almost impossible to read. Fowler describes this as the verbless convulsive. And he quotes an excellent line from the author Flaubert. "The author in his work must be like God in the universe, present everywhere and visible nowhere." And that's exactly what's wrong with this type of thing. You can see somebody laboring for an effect. Now, to avoid that, you're much better to give up the emphasis that you can get from a fragment, eschew them all together, and simply put in all your subjects and predicates if you have to. All right, that's a little aside on fragments. Now let's go back to the homework of number two. Now, what is the main clause of number two? Say? Well, what is... Now, what did I do wrong? I said the main clause, and the trouble is there's only one clause in this statement, right? So you don't talk about the main clause if there's only one clause. Is coming into the room a clause? No, it is not. Why not? No subject, no predicate. What part, what form of language is coming?
Participle.
It's a participle, right. So the whole thing, coming into the room, is? Participial phrase, functioning in this case as what part of speech? An adjective modifying
Jack.
Correct. So therefore, we really only have one thought. Jack began to remove his coat. And then this just happens to be like Big Jack, only it's coming into the room Jack. But it's still simply an adjective. Now the rest we've done, began to remove his coat. I simply point out to you that even though one and two are basically the same sentence, the first is two clauses, you see. The second is the same thought, but it's in the form of an adjective, not a clause. All right, let's go to number three. Italy owes a historic debt to her great sculptors. How many clauses in that statement? One. What is the subject? Italy. What is the predicate? Owes. All right, now raise your hand if you know what is the object, which would be, of course, the complement. Any complement is an object. What is the object in the back, Miss Bucher? Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Yes.
All right, give me the whole phrase, which is the object. Debt is the single word. A historic debt. That's what Italy owes, right? That is called the object. And of course, the noun is debt and ahistoric are adjectives. Now, what are we going to do with "to her great sculptors"? To her great sculptors. That's also a noun, and it's also related to the verb, but it doesn't tell you directly what. It doesn't tell you directly what is owed. It tells you something more indirect about the verb, to whom the debt is owed. And who knows what is the name given to an object which is indirectly rather than directly related to the verb.
Indirect.
It's called an indirect object. So in this case, sculptors is the indirect object, or the whole phrase would be to her great sculptors. There are many verbs that take indirect and direct objects. The direct is what. The indirect is to whom, but you don't always have to express the two. For instance, Italy owes her sculptors a debt. In English, if you put the indirect object first, you don't need a preposition. You don't need the two. So you'll have two objects right together. Owes her sculptors a debt. One is what she owes, the other is the beneficiary, the recipient. That's called the indirect object. And there are quite a number of verbs in English which can take indirect as well as direct. For instance, lend. Lend me your ears. What's the direct object of the verb lend? Direct. Ears, correct. What is the indirect? Me. Lend to me, you see. You could just as well have said, lend your ears to me. The test of an indirect object is, can you put it as part of a prepositional phrase with to in front of it? Gives takes an indirect object in addition to a direct. Give him the book. Write her a letter, etc. Yes, Jim?
All right, in that case, then, just the word sculptors is the indirect
object. Is the indirect object, correct. But you can talk about the whole phrase functioning as the indirect object, but the simple indirect object is the word sculpture. Right.
Is the same thing true in compliments? The compliment is the whole phrase? Or
the compliment is usually the whole phrase required to complete the thought. Now, let us go on to this next. What is the subject of the next construction? A debt she can never repay. Now, think. What is the subject? No. She is the subject of she can never repay. She can never repay is a little clause modifying debt. Tells you what type of debt. It's an adjective clause. But I'm saying of the whole construction, what is the subject? There is no subject. What is the verb? There is no verb. This is a fragment again. This is a fragment again, so of course it is subject to the remarks we made earlier about fragments. This is a poor construction. There's no conceivable reason that I could think of to give this kind of emphasis to a fragment. And why did the person get into this trouble? He wanted to say something about debt, and he felt his sentence was very awkward if he stuck it where it belonged grammatically. He wanted to say, Italy owes a historic debt, a debt she can never repay, to her great sculptors. And he felt that that broke up the flow of his sentence. So he took out that and stuck it at the end. And of course, this is a typical method of writing, which is not good. What would be much better would be to reconstruct it so that you get it in one sentence without that awkwardness. And there are many ways of doing it. For instance, you had a suggestion?
Yeah.
Well, that's the same thing, though. It's stuck in the middle.
Or Italy owes a historic debt to a great sculpture. It is a debt.
Well, then you can make it into two sentences. What you just did, what else might you do, Howard?
One she can never repay.
Italy owes a historic debt, comma, one she can never repay?
No, Italy owes a historic debt to a great sculpture, comma, one she can never
repay. Yes, you could put a comma on one, but then you're still fairly distant from debt. One, of course, is singular, so it obviously couldn't mean sculptors, but there's still something else you could do, yes? Well, but then it sounds like it's sculptors she can never repay, rather than debt. It could take some wording, but for instance, why not just, to her great sculptors, Italy owes a historic debt she can never repay. Just reconstruct it so you have your whole thing in one. I'm not holding out for that. I'm simply saying there are many ways of redoing it, but to tear off this and make it a fragment at the end is the poorest. Now, I want to introduce you to... yes?
It's not clearly why that's poor.
It's poor because it's a needless fragment. Fragments have to be used very, very sparingly. Not because of inadequacies of sentence construction, but because of deliberate quest of emphasis. And in this case, it's simply he didn't know how to write the sentence. I know because I made it up. I did it deliberately as an exercise, but this type of thing comes up all the time. There's nothing here to justify that type of fragment. A fragment must be very, very rare. Generally speaking, a fragment is guilty until proven innocent, unless you have some special context of emphasis to justify it. By the way, Where is the, in that fragment, suppose we implied, it is a debt she can never repay. Where is the conjunction joining she can never repay to the noun debt that it modifies? It's missing. This is an implied conjunction. In this case, it would be a debt which or a debt that she can never repay. Now, I want to introduce the name for this type of entity. Italy owes a historic debt, a debt she can never repay. Now, there's two nouns. In that case, it happens to be the same word twice, right following one after the other, right? Who knows what that is called when one noun, I'll give you a more exact definition in a moment, immediately follows a preceding and helps to elaborate or explain. She owes a debt, and then I immediately give an elaboration, a debt she can never repay. Who knows what it's called to have one noun immediately following a preceding and explaining it? There's a special name for that, which I want you to know, which I didn't have the courage to introduce last time because it's a big word and I thought it might collapse your circuit. Marianne. It's called an appositive. You see the spelling right there. The second noun is said to be in apposition to the first, in the same position. So, a debt she can never repay is an appositive. It's in the same position as debt. Now, generally speaking, an appositive is defined as follows, if you want to take this down. A substantive directly following a substantive and used to elaborate or explain it. In other words, the second substantive elaborates or explains the first. A substantive directly following a substantive and used to elaborate or explain it. As, she owes a debt she can never repay. Debt is a noun and it follows debt. Now I say substantive because it's not always two nouns. You might have a pronoun and a noun. And remember last time we gave examples of things which were not either noun or pronoun, but were substantives, like phrases or clauses. A noun or a noun equivalent is what's meant by a substantive. And a positive can be anything which functions as a noun. Now let's take some example. John Smith, my uncle, was very famous. Which is the appositive? My uncle. My uncle, right. Actually, the word uncle is the noun following John Smith and elaborating it. So it's in exactly the same position. It's like a parenthesis explaining that. So you'd say the subject is John Smith. My uncle is not the subject. It is simply in apposition to the subject. It's an appositive. It's a noun in this case used to explain. Now, you can have a whole string of them. My uncle, John Smith, the author of Destiny, was famous. What's the first appositive? J. Smith. What is the second appositive? The author of Destiny. So we've got there two nouns in a row.
Is it the whole phrase rather than just the noun?
The whole phrase is considered the appositive, although the essence of it is the noun in this case. Now, and you can of course have a whole string of them. Now if you had to look at that sentence, what is the subject? What single word of that second? Uncle. All the rest are simply appositives, further elaborations of uncle, but the grammatical structure is uncle was. And what, by the way, is the complement of that, just to remind you? Famous. Yes, because that completes the thought. In this case, the verb to be has to be completed by something and requires an adjective. What is the appositive in the next one? The word ain't is not in good repute. Ain't is an appositive. The word, of course, used as a thing you're talking about. So ain't in this construction is used to stand for the word ain't. It stands for the thing you're talking about. So it functions as a noun, and it's in apposition to what noun? Word. So what is the subject of that sentence? Word. What is the predicate? Is. What is ain't? And a positive, a noun standing for an explaining word.
Ain't the real subject of that sentence?
No. Grammatically, and a positive is never the subject. You're doing a comparable thing to what you did last time. You're trying to go to your knowledge of the meaning, not the grammatical structure. The grammatical structure here is the word is not. And then a sideline is which word? This word. I'm bringing in a word in apposition. Yes.
You have to keep in mind the word following, right? The one that's following all.
The one when following is the apostle.
So
correct.
It depends upon the structure of the sentence. Which one you
follow? That's correct. Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
Just
let me elaborate that. If I had said ain't, comma, a common word, comma, is not in good repute, a common word would be the apostle. Correct. Yes.
In trying to figure it out, I just said which one could the sentence stand without and still being there?
No, because the sentence could stand, for instance, without uncle. I could have said John Smith, the author of Destiny, was famous. You see, what it comes to is the first noun that you introduce takes the place in the listener's mind of the subject. And there's no more room, so the rest is just heard as,
right,
you see, sort of like a modifier. It's like a noun modifier, you see. Now, I put the last one in because it'll give you an example of a whole clause functioning as an appositive. This is an appositive noun clause, which is a wonderful thing to have at a cocktail party. Now, what is the noun that is the subject of this statement? The idea that wealth is important is true. What noun is the subject?
Idea.
And, of course, the predicate is. Excuse me. Yes, is. The last is. The idea is true. Now, what do we do with that wealth is important? That's a clause, right? It has a subject, wealth. A predicate, is. A complement, important. And it even has a conjunction, right? Uniting it to the rest. So that wealth is important is definitely a clause. It doesn't stand by itself, right? It's not a main clause. You couldn't come in and say that wealth is important. So it's some type of clause. What type of clause is it? Is it an adjective, an adverb, or a noun? That's your only three choice. It's a noun. You could come in and, without the word idea and say that wealth is important is true, right? In which case, that collection of words functions as a noun. Well, here we have a noun clause that wealth is important, elaborating a noun, idea, telling you which idea you're talking about. So it's just like my Uncle Smith, the idea, that so-and-so, right? And therefore we have a noun clause in apposition, because any substantive which is used to explain a proceeding is an apposition. So here, that wealth is important is an appositive noun clause. Yes, Kat? Because to be an adjective, it would have to have a different construction. It would have to be like this. The idea which I told you yesterday is true. Then it would be, you're describing to me an attribute of the idea. But here you're telling me what the idea is by giving me a substantive. You see, this could stand by itself. An adjective couldn't. Take those two examples. The idea which I told you yesterday is true. I could not come in and simply say, which I told you yesterday is true, right? Which I told you yesterday obviously modifies something, and without the noun that it modifies, it just falls flat. But that wealth is important is itself not a modifier, it's a noun. It functions as the whole idea. So it is not describing the idea, it is another noun in apposition to the preceding identifying that idea. Now perhaps the best way, if you can stand this technicality, is this, that is the statement, the idea that wealth is true. That before wealth is not the same that as the idea that I told you, or the idea that is on the board. That is not the same that. Can you see why? Take the sentence, the idea that I told you, right? That, in that statement, is a relative pronoun. tying idea to I told you, and therefore the whole thing modifies idea. And notice that that has a function in that I told you. It's the object of the verb, right? The idea that I told you. I told you that, right? It functions as the object of the subordinate clause. Or the idea that is on the board is also a clause used as a modifier of idea. And the that is a relative pronoun. And in this case, functions as the subject. The idea that is the subject of is, right? In those two cases, you have a relative, the that is a relative pronoun. But in this case, the that is not a subject or an object. It does not function as a pronoun, but as a pure conjunction, you see. And consequently, it is not describing the type of idea. It is simply introducing a substantive. You get that? So when I say the idea that wealth is important, that is not a subject or an object. It does not function as a pronoun, you see. It's simply a pure conjunction. And it's used to introduce, that is the arch word used to introduce a noun clause. Not all noun clauses are introduced by that, but when they start with that, they are almost always noun clauses in this type of construction. Now, we'll be repeating this later. Did you follow that at all, what I just said? We will be repeating it later. Now, you see, you could say, in a way, this tells you what idea. So in a certain way, it modifies it, but it modifies it the way an appositive does, not the way an adjective does. An appositive gives you, like my uncle, John Smith, tells you something about my uncle, but it's still a noun, right? When you have a modifying noun, that's called an appositive. And that's the same thing here. Yes.
I'm a little confused. You're saying the idea that I told you, that I told you is an adjective?
No, no. That I told you is an adjective clause, modifying idea.
I guess what confuses me is I thought an adjective was giving one property of the noun,
no.
And there are others.
An adjective, an adjective is simply a phrase, a word, a phrase, a clause characterizing a substance. It does not, there's nothing about whether it's one or more than one or whether there's others, that's an entirely separate question. I never said such a thing in regard to adjectives. Yes. Substantive is a noun or noun equivalent. And that means basically a noun, a pronoun, or a phrase or clause which functions as a noun. Like, look, to run, comma, an activity which is demanding, comma, you see, then activity is in apposition to run. Yes. Yes, except it isn't self-contained because it still has to have a predicate or a subject. What? Exactly. Yes, in that sense, this gives you the whole thought. It's a noun that wealth is important, as opposed to being simply a description of something else. That's correct. We'll have more examples of this. So it'll become clear in time. Let's go to number four. How many clauses in number four? Three, correct. Who can find a main clause? Yes. Two main clauses is correct. Two main clauses by the standard that they're what stands by themselves. What are the two? Well, now give me one at a time. Learning may be easy. And the second? No, don't say the but. The but is a conjunction. Teaching is work. As the two main clauses. What is the subject of the first, darling? What is the predicate?
Maybe.
Well, technically the predicate is may. Because what is be? Now that's a tricky question to tell you what is be. Or would it help you if I said you could equally well say it is possible for learning to be easy, because that's the same be. In which case, to be would be an infinitive, right? Here, this happens to be an infinitive where the to doesn't appear. And what part of speech is easy? It's an adjective describing learning. Is learning a noun? But it comes from a verb, right? It's a gerund, right. Is that true, by the way, of the learning that comes in next in that sentence? If you are learning, is that a gerund?
No,
it's not. Part of the verb, right. Okay, now teaching is work. What is a gerund there? Yes. What is the complement of teaching is work? The complement never includes the predicate. Work. What part of speech is work? Nouns, right, okay. Now, well, what do we do with if you are learning from a good teacher? We had two main clauses and a non-main. What type of a clause is this, if you are learning from a good teacher?
Adverbial.
It's an adverbial clause. What does it modify? Well, it tells you under what conditions it may be easy. It really modifies may be, which is an expanded predicate. It tells you the conditions under which this will hold up. So it's an adverbial clause. The conjunction is if that ties it in. What is the subject of that adverbial clause? What part of speech?
Pronoun.
What's the verb? The whole verb. The verb.
Our learning.
Right. Made of two words in this case. What do you do with from a good teacher? What is that? Yes. Prepositional phrase functioning in this case as what? An adverb. Correct. Telling you how you're learning. Okay. Let's move on. I don't want to spend the whole night on this. Yes. Only if this is really urgent now. Yes.
The question is, how does it happen that our learning is a verb phrase where maybe is not?
Because in this case, our learning is the minimum required to get the action out. In the other, may is the minimum required, and B tells you what may. Because may is short for it is possible. That will become clearer to you when we get to the forms of verbs. Okay. Number five. This, of course, is Lincoln. Just to show you that you can do real sentences and not just these made-up things. How many clauses in number five? Well, I know that you know the answers. I'd like to see some different hands here. How many clauses in number five? Yes, at the back there. Can't hear you. No. Tell me the two that you found. Well, that what we say here and what they did there here are certainly two clauses. What about all the rest of it? Don't they have subjects and verbs? So you didn't care. You know, your clauses have to exhaust your whole sentence. By the time you got, you gave me the non-main clauses, but what about the main clause? What about the world will little note nor long remember? That's a clause, right? Why is it a clause? What's the subject? World. Now think, what is the verb? Now you got a tricky question. What is the verb? Will note, and what else? Well, no, nor is not a... Remember. This is what's called a compound verb. It's just one clause because it's only one subject, world. But you add two verbs. So it's simply considered a single clause with a compound verb. So the verbs are will note, and then will is implied for remember. What part of speech is nor?
Conjunction.
In this case, joining the two verbs. So what is the whole main clause? Now think. What is the whole main clause in the first line there? The world will little note nor long remember. Well, and then, what we say here is a separate clause, right? It has a subject, we, predicate, say, right? Therefore, what part of speech is what we say here? It functions as the object of note and remember. Therefore, it must be a noun. Only a substantive can be an object, right? So, if we want to analyze it, we'd have to say the main clause is, the world will little note nor long remember that. Remember, if we break what up into that which, and then the rest is what type of that. So what we say here is a noun clause functioning as the object. What part of speech is little? An adverb. How they will note. What part of speech is long? Same thing, adverb. All right, but we've said as a conjunction. And give me another main clause now that can stand by itself. Yes. It can never forget, right. And subject it, predicate can, never adverb, and forget is again an infinitive. It is unable to forget, you see. What they did here. What they did here is a clause, subject they, predicate did. What is the conjunction that joins they, what that they did here to it can never forget? Yes. What, correct. What type of clause is what they did here?
Noun.
Noun clause, functioning as what in relation to the verb will forget, can forget. Object, right. Okay, number six. Well, how many clauses in number six? This is a summary of Kant. How many clauses?
Six.
Correct. How many got that right? Very good. That's excellent. If you got that right, very good. Six clauses. Now let's see. What is the first main clause? Put up your hand if you know with the first main clause. Now, are you going to tell me it is not enough? Because if you're going to tell me that, it's wrong. It is wrong because it is not part of the grammar of this sentence. It is one of those empty filler words that starts you off, which we called an expletive. What is the actual clause, the main clause? Yes.
That a man do the right thing is not enough.
That's the whole thing. But then, that a man do the right thing is in itself a clause, right? That a man do the right thing. Subject? Man. Predicate, do. It even has an object, a complement, the right thing, right? And it has a conjunction, that. So it's obviously a clause in itself, and that whole clause functions as the subject of is. What do you call a clause that functions as a subject? Noun clause. So that a man do the right thing is a noun clause, subject of is. So what is the main clause by itself, then, without that whole noun clause? Yes. The only way you can express it is X is not enough. Something is not enough, and then the noun clause tells you what the something is. So the main clause here is like X is not enough. Yes.
If you were to say he knows best who something or other.
Yes.
You wouldn't call he an X, you'd call it a pronoun.
That's correct. But this does not. This is not. It knows, which would be the subject of an action. This is just a way of saying something is not enough. What? That a man do the right thing. It's just a way of getting the sentence off the ground. It's like giving a temporary replacement for the subject because the guy doesn't want to give the whole thing. That a man do the right thing is not enough because he's afraid it's too much for the person to take in. So he wants to give the structure first. X is not enough. By X, I mean so-and-so. That's what it as an expletive is for. All right, what do you do with that his acts be in accord with duty? That has a subject, acts. Predicate, be. Complement in accord with duty. Conjunction, that. So the thing is obviously a clause. Now, who can tell me what that clause is? What kind of clause is it? Noun, adjective, or adverb? Jim?
I think it's a noun.
It's a noun. But now, how could we have a noun clause right after a noun clause? Right. This is an appositive noun clause following a noun clause. In other words, That he do the right thing, that a man do the right thing, is not enough, is the main thought. And then they're saying, by the way, by this first noun, we mean that his act be in accord with duty. So it's a noun clause used to explain a noun clause. So there's two clauses there, you see, and then you have the main clause, X is not enough. Okay, who can find a prepositional phrase in that what we've done up to now? Yes.
There are two actually, in accord and with duty.
In accord with duty. What is the preposition?
In and with is another one.
Well, actually, in accord with is regarded as one preposition, right. Like according to. Okay, I think we've done, let's continue that sentence. What is the next main clause? The moral man must act from duty, right? That's a main clause because it stands entirely by itself. Subject is man, predicate must, etc. All right, I want another main clause in that same sentence. He must do his duty. That again stands by itself. Now we've got, simply because it is his duty. That's still another clause, right? What part of speech does simply because it is his duty function as? Adjective, adverb, noun.
Adverb.
Why he must do his duty, right? Explains why he must do it. So it's an adverbial clause. What part of speech is simply? No. And an adverb, modifying what? No, you can't have an adverb modifying a noun, so that finishes that theory. Yes. You could say it modifies because, which itself is an adverbial conjunction. And you could say it tells not that it's only because, you see, this is the type of because. Or you could say it modifies the whole clause. Because it is his duty, simply. Okay, so you have six clauses there. How many main clauses? Three. X is not enough. The moral man must act from duty. He must do his duty. And then, in addition, two noun clauses as the subject of is, that makes five, and an adverbial clause makes six. Six clauses. All right, let's go to number seven. This is from Atlas.
One, you have to have one main clause.
No, sir.
What is the definition of the
main clause? A main clause is any clause which can stand by itself grammatically. And I deliberately gave you this sentence because it has three main clauses. The preceding one has two. You can have any number of main clauses. That's what we're going to get to tonight. But first, let me zip through number seven, which is not exactly the ideal one to zip through. This was the Taggart terminal, she thought, etc. What is the first main clause? Stop when you get to it. Yes. Well, you are interpreting it differently. It doesn't say she thought that this was the Taggart terminal. If it read that way, then she thought would be the main clause. But she thought here actually functions as an aside, a parenthesis. Is simply indicating this is going on in her mind, but it's not part of the structure of the grammar. The whole grammar is actually her thought. So leave aside she thought, which is just a parenthesis. What is the actual first main clause? Cynthia. This was the Taggart terminal. What's the subject?
This.
What part of speech is this? It's a pronoun because it stands for a noun. This, she's presumably pointing to something in her mind. The rest is clear. What do you do with this room? Isn't that funny? That's another noun following a pronoun. And elaborating what you mean by this. This room, so we have a noun following a pronoun and elaborating it. That's an appositive, this room. It's in apposition to this. What part of speech is this before room? An adjective. Same word. Was a pronoun, now it's an adjective. Right. Okay. Not the giant concourse in New York. What do you do with that? Now this is the giant concourse is a noun following the this, but it's negated. So if you want to make up a fancy term, you could call this a negative or positive. Right. That sounds contradictory because it sounds like negative positive, but it's apositive. What, by the way, part of speech is not? He ate, he did not eat. Both tell you, but not tells you something very crucial about the action, namely, it didn't happen. So it's an adverb, right? All right. So we've got only one main clause here in a string of a positive. Yes, sir. In this case, it implicitly modifies, it was not. You see, it modifies the verb. We have a main clause, this was the Taggart terminal. Who can find another main clause? Now there's dashes. Dashes tell you right away the grammar starts over now. Now she could have put a period there, Miss Rand, and started again, but the dashes, she wants you to take the whole thing in one gulp to get the overall emotional effect, you see, not break it up into separate units. So she deliberately keeps it going, and that's the function of a dash, which we'll come in on later. But for now, where's the next main clause? This was her goal, subject and predicate. What do you do with the end of track? That's an appositive after goal. The point beyond the curve of the earth, what's that? Another appositive. Point and then beyond the curve and of the earth are two adjective phrases. Now, where starts a new clause? Tell me if you can find a new clause. No. Who can find another clause now? We got up to earth. Kathy. Say again. Clause, you have to give me a subject and a predicate. Well, the whole thing from where? Where the two straight lines of rail met and vanished, drawing her forward. What's the subject of that? Lines, and the rest is adjectives. What's the predicate? A compound predicate. Met, vanished. Right? Drawing her forward is simply a participial phrase modifying lines. What type of clause is where the two straight lines of rail met and vanished? It's the point where all this happened. It's an adjective clause, that's all. As they had drawn Nathaniel Taggart, what do you do with that? Would it help you? No, well, I won't help you. Is that a main or a non-main clause? Non-main, right. Well, then it has to, is it a noun? Obviously not. What kind of function does this? Tell you how they drew her forward, right? What is the conjunction there? As. This actually is the same type of word as which or that. What does as actually mean in this construction? In which manner, you see. So it's like a form of which. So we have another clause there. Who could find out? This dash is another main clause. What's the next main clause? This was the goal. Now, Nathaniel Taggart had seen in the distance is a adjective clause modifying goal. And there's a conjunction. This was the point, etc., is the last main clause, and holding is a participial phrase, and then the rest of it is all prepositional phrases. So how many main clauses? This was the Taggart terminal. This was her goal. This was the goal. This was the point. You see, what keeps this sentence functioning, although it's enormously complex, is the leitmotif of the main clauses over and over being this was it, this was it, this was it. And you can string all these complex qualifiers on it, because you have one simple structural thread, the same reiterated main clause. Okay, I take it now that you are basically an expert in the following things. You can take a given sentence, divide it up for me into clauses, and where appropriate into phrases. Within each clause, you can identify for me subject, predicate, and where appropriate, complement. And then you can go through it one word at a time and tell me the part of speech. Now, since you can do all that, we're prepared to go on. I'm going to save taking up these exercises on the bottom of that for a later period, perhaps the end tonight if we have time. But while you still have some mind left, I want to go into some new and very important theory. Now, I realize this is difficult because it's a lot of homework drill, and while you're still reeling from that, I'm giving you new theory. It will be easier hereafter because I'll put the new theory at the beginning before you are knocked out by an hour of drill, but it was required tonight because if you didn't have this stuff at your fingertips, it would just collapse you. Probably will anyway, but at least we tried. Now, we want to start tonight a topic we're going to be on this time and next time, the topic of coordination and subordination. Coordination and subordination. Coordination, to tell you just in general, means the same order of importance. Subordination means one thing is under or lesser in importance than another. It's of a lesser order, a suborder. So, for instance, just to make this clear in a simple example, if you are all paying students, you are coordinate in my mind, of equal weight and importance. But suppose I have a relative visiting who isn't paying. He, in my mind, is subordinate of a lesser order of significance. He's not entitled to the same attention and so on. He's a side issue, you see. Now, that's just a homey example which we will apply to grammar. Now, broadly for 2 weeks, we're going to be on the topic of how to indicate when elements of your thought are coordinate and when they are subordinate to others. In other words, how to bring out the important and not the unimportant. Now, to do that, we have to discuss various types of sentence structure. You've had a little glimmer from the homework that sentences can be much more complicated than simply Jack hit the ball. They can have all kinds of complexities to them. A sentence can have many, many elements and still fulfill the original definition. What was the definition that we gave? Sentence is a group of words expressing a complete thought. But a complete thought may contain many constituent thoughts, many sub-thoughts, so related that the total is still only one complete thought. And that's what I want to develop now. The idea of sentences with several thoughts, that is, several sub-thoughts, several clauses, but the whole totality is offered as one complete thought for a specific purpose. Now, let's start first with what is called a simple sentence. A simple sentence is defined as a sentence comprising one clause only, one subject, one predicate. That's it. And if you want an example, look to the notes for Lecture 2, Number 2. The boy spoke to the teacher, period. Subject and predicate, one clause. He was frightened, period. The teacher was angry. The boy spoke softly. He wanted to appease the teacher. The boy wanted a higher grade. The teacher refused. The teacher is cruel. Maybe he is trying to be fair. This is Dick and Jane Ing. Each is a simple sentence. By simple meaning, it's a technical definition. Subject and a predicate, one clause only. Boy spoke. He was. Teacher was. Boy spoke. He wanted. You can't get more basic than that. Now, we very often think like this. One short snippet at a time. One point, then another, then another. But it is very poor to express yourself in writing by this method. You make an attempt to do something with those units, to organize them in some way. Why? What is wrong with this method of writing if you imagine it protracted page after page? Now, there's a simple epistemological explanation of what's wrong with it. Something in the very nature of the way the human mind functions, if you know Miss Rand's theory of concepts, there's a very simple explanation of what's wrong with this method. Yes? Too many concretes, or put it another way, because they may be abstract statements, too many units. Too many units to hold. If you remember a point, which I'm not going to reiterate now, but I hope you're familiar with what we call the crow epistemology. The mind has a limited number of units that it can deal with and retain at any given time. If you overload it, you give it too many units, it simply goes blank. The mind tunes out, it can't take it in. Remember, the purpose of concepts, according to Miss Rand, is to reduce the massive number of perceptual units into just one word, which stands for all of the instances. It's basically a unit reduction function. Now, you will find this throughout grammar. Techniques right and left for the purposes of reducing units and therefore making it easier for the mind to take the material in and deal with it. In this case, even from this little paragraph number 2, you experience it as choppy. A whole bunch of things, and at a certain point, you just can't take it in anymore. What do you want to do? You try to find some kind of relations among the units, some kind of organization, some kind of structure, so you don't have that much to deal with. Now, of course, every sentence is a unit by definition. The period says, this is the end of that unit, start a new one. So what we try to do is put related thoughts together in the same sentence and thereby reduce the number of units. That's the basic motive behind more complicated sentence structure. To reduce the number of units by putting related thoughts into one sentence. Now, there are different ways of doing this. One method might be simply combine these units into bundles, in effect. Take them just as they stand and combine them into a longer sentence, that's all. Now, if you look at number 3, you will see the same simple sentences, but now combined. The first, of course, is the same, but starting with, he was frightened, the boy spoke to the teacher, that's a simple sentence. He was frightened and the teacher was angry. Now, I made a unit out of that by combining two simple sentences. I did it, of course, by means of a word. Which word? And. I've underscored. That's the conjunction. That functions to combine the two. Why am I entitled to do this? What is similar about those two simple sentences that entitles me to put the two together into one statement? Even though it's two thoughts. Yes. They give you the emotional setup of the situation. And therefore, you have a logical reason to justify putting the two together. And now I've taken two units from my first example and made one out of it. So the mind now can hold that as just one unit. Now let's go on. The boy spoke softly for he wanted to appease the teacher. Again, I've taken two elements and made one. By means of what word functioning as the conjunction? For underscored. And what is the logic of this combination? What am I making one thought out of? Gives you the reason for the first. So it's an action plus its reason, which is a very logical unit to make as one unit. The boy wanted a higher grade, but the teacher refused. Again, two simples combined with a conjunction And what is the logic of that combination? What does the but tell you? Yes. Yes, that the something happened that contradicted the first half, so the two are logically united as a thought. You wanted, but you didn't. And then, the teacher is cruel, or maybe he is trying to be fair. The or is the conjunction, which I've underscored. And what's the logic of uniting the two of them together?
Yes. Only one of the two of them is true.
Two different theories of the teacher's character. Now, you see, I've taken 8 units and reduced them to 4. And if you try in the privacy of your own home reading it, you will find that although it's not ideal prose, it's much easier to take in and retain because I don't just throw 9 units at you. There's a certain logic, a certain relationships. Now, this type of statement is known as a compound sentence. A compound sentence is defined as 2 or more simple sentences united into a single whole. Two or more simple sentences united into a single whole. Now notice, in regard to compound sentences, each element, each of those subunits, is itself an independent thought and can stand alone grammatically. For instance, he was frightened. The teacher was angry. Those are both separate thoughts. They could stand alone. So they are what we call a main clause and a main clause, right? Each is, in fact, they're the identical words that we had as simple sentences, only they're conjoined with a conjunction. That's all. So each element is still a separate, independent thought. But our structure indicates we don't want them taken alone. We want them taken together as a unit. However, they still get equal weight. They still have the weight of a main clause and a main clause. So they would be called, if we use the words coordinate or subordinate, coordinate. Right, they're 2 coordinate elements of one sentence. And we achieve this by means of a conjunction, certain specific conjunctions. And I've given you some examples, and, for, but, or. All right, now let's take one more step before our break. Compound sentences represent a definite advance in terms of unit reduction. But nevertheless, it's not yet an ideal solution in many cases, because a string of compound sentences has very much the same effect as a string of simple sentences. Pretty soon it becomes monotonous and you just have a whole bunch of units mechanically tied together. You know, the type of person that tells you a story such as, the street was bare and not a soul was visible and the car went crashing on and then we saw a child just round the curve and then, well, that is a compound sentence with a whole bunch of things connected by ands, but it doesn't really help you to relate the units. Why not? Because it doesn't distinguish what's more important from what's less important. In a compound sentence, they're all main clauses. They're all coordinate. They're all equally important. And therefore, we lose a crucial thing, the stress, the ability to say, this is the essence, this is a side issue. Now, what we need then is a way of combining units according to importance, so that certain things will be featured as the essence of the thought and others will be subordinate, a lesser order of importance. And of course, a clause which is subordinate will be a subordinate clause. That would mean a clause that no longer grammatically could stand on its own. It's not a main clause. It functions as an adjective, an adverb, a noun. In that case, we can take our string of simples and decide what is the essence of this. Put the essence in main clauses and thread all the rest on in the form of subordinate clauses. And you will see a huge difference. Now look at 4A, for example. Read 4A to yourself. Not. Now, you'd have to grant, this is not ideal prose, of course, but it's obviously head and shoulders above the preceding. Why? We have made a crucial difference between what's important and what isn't. Now, what I have done is put the main clauses underscored. So if you look at it, you'll see, although the teacher was angry and the boy frightened, what type of clause is that? It's a subordinate, and it modifies something. What? It tells the conditions under which he spoke, right? So it's an adverbial clause. So now I've taken that whole thought, the teacher was angry and the boy frightened, and I've said to my reader, in effect, this is merely a sideline. This is merely the condition under which something important happened. But I want you to focus on the important. The boy spoke to the teacher. That's the main cause. And I've taken the rest and stuck it in a subordinate clause. You see, and now the boy spoke to the teacher has an emphasis that he was frightened and teacher was angry doesn't have. Now look at the next. Speaking softly. Now I took a whole sentence. The boy spoke softly and made a participial phrase out of it, right? Which is even less than a clause. I just throw it away. It now becomes a mere adjective, right? And not even a clause. So that he might appease the teacher. What kind of clause is that? That's the purpose of his speaking. Purpose of an action is an adverb. Adverbial clause. What is left to be the noun? The main clause. He asked for a higher grade. But the teacher, and now, who was either cruel or trying to be fair, is simply a modifier of teacher, an adjective clause. Now, when you read this, even though you don't know it, what your mind retains is now really three units. The essence you get is the boy spoke to the teacher, he asked for a higher grade, the teacher refused, you see. All the rest may be important, but you have indicated by your structure it's a sideline, it's a side issue, and therefore the mind takes it in like cream puff. It's really easy and it comes right in. Because you said, this is important, this is a sideline. Now, of course, there's no reason why you had to choose that. Depending on your context, you could have had different main clauses. Look at 4b and read it. Same exact content, but now I have different main clauses completely. Read 4b now. Now look at the difference. In 4a, the boy spoke to the teacher as the essence of the thought. In 4b, what happens to the boy spoke to the teacher? I simply say, when they spoke. So in other words, it becomes an adverbial clause telling you something much more important. It is merely the condition under which something much more important happened, namely what? The teacher was angry and the boy was frightened at the exact reverse emphasis of 4a, you see. By speaking softly as he asked for a higher grade, the boy tried to appease the teacher. Well, the main clause is here, the boy tried to appease the teacher. And instead of, in the first one, he asked for a higher grade was the essence, now, as he asked for a higher grade is simply, what? Is simply the timing of him trying to appease the teacher. So it's simply an adverb. But the teacher who refused the request, and now who refused the request, simply has a side characterization of the teacher. And your main focus is the teacher is cruel. Now you see, this is the same content in what you could call the emotional version, where your main clauses feature what they're feeling. So the story the reader retains is, the teacher was angry and the boy was frightened. The boy tried to appease the teacher. The teacher is cruel. Now, from this version, it's beside, you know, whether he asked for a raise or a higher grade or he didn't get it is a side issue. It's a detail. What sinks into the reader's mind is fear, appeasement, cruelty. Whereas the first is what you could call an existential version. He spoke. He asked. No, you see. It's the exact same content, but it's all the difference in the world in what your reader retains. And why is that? Because of what is in the main clause versus what is in the subordinate clause. When you put something in a main clause, the mind unavoidably takes this in as the essence, because that's what stands alone. When you put it in a subordinate clause, the mind takes it as simply a modifier or an element of something else, and does not retain it with that kind of weight or emphasis. Now, if you grasp this, you grasp one of the most essential principles of good writing, which is put your important thought in your main clause. We're going to elaborate that after a short break. All right, I want to continue our discussion of subordination. A subordinate clause may be important. Obviously, if it wasn't worth saying, you wouldn't put it in. But the point is, it is not the essence of the thought. And therefore, we distinguish firmly between a subordinate clause and a main clause. The main clause is the central, the key thought, the emphatic unit. The other is a modifier, a qualifier, a side issue. Now, all writing and all thinking requires this kind of distinction. It requires highlighting, arranging words and thoughts so that you make the essence stand out from the side issues. I'd like you to see the broader background of this. Broader than simply sentence structure. And the way to see that is for me to contrast thought with egalitarianism. Now, you know that objectivism rejects egalitarianism morally and politically. That is the idea that every man is interchangeably as valuable as every other. But the same principle holds true in epistemology, in the acquisition of knowledge. In every aspect of thought and communication, you must discriminate. You must say, this is important, this is not as important. Now, for instance, if you know the objectivist theory of definition, you know that if someone says to you, what is freedom? It is a completely unsatisfactory, worthless answer to say, freedom is the state in which there's no government controls over interest, housing, mortgages, etc., and list off 50 concretes, because no one can retain it. You know that you have to give a capsule essential statement, the recognition of individual rights, and then you can treat all the concretes as so many elaborations, expressions, consequences of it. And this is why we must have definition in terms of essential. You don't even need anything this highfalutin to grasp the point. You know the type of person when you ask them about a movie they saw, what's it about? And the type who says, well, it started when the guy was standing on the street and then a truck came by and then the driver got out, and they give you every point, scene by scene, and of course, you can't possibly take it in. It's just an agglomeration of details with no essence, no distinction of what's important and what isn't, and you just tune out. Whereas if the guy said, it's about a werewolf being president of the United States, you get the essence. And then he can bring in details, how many sub-vice presidents he has and so on. In other words, whether it's a movie or a definition or whatever the subject is, the mind works by constant contrast of emphasis. It has to be guided all the time by this is important, this is a side issue. And in that sense, egalitarianism is the exact opposite of thought. Now, all of this applies to sentence structure. You cannot be egalitarian in the presentation of your thoughts. You must decide what is the essence of your thought. That gets the main clause. And what is a side issue? And that goes into the subordinate clause. So the essence of good writing, good thinking, as regard to this point anyway, is your structural emphasis must correspond to your view of the content's importance. Your structural emphasis must correspond to your view of the content's importance. If something is important, it gets a main clause. If not, not. Now, this is, in a way, the expression in writing of a famous architectural principle. What am I thinking of?
Form follows
function. This is form follows function in writing. And therefore, if you're keeping track of errors, one truly profound error of writing style is not to subordinate. That could be either in the form of everything as simple sentences or everything as compound sentences. Remember, compound doesn't subordinate either. Now, I do not want you to draw from this the conclusion that it's always wrong to have simple or compound sentences. Obviously, that's not true. When both parts of a sentence are equal in importance, and you want to express this, then you need a compound sentence without subordination. But the point is, you must use this deliberately and realize that you're doing it. This presentation of every thought as equal to another can't be your regular habitual method. The regular habitual routine method must be subordination to the important. Coordination is a special technique when your content justifies. Now look at number 5, just as an example of the differences between subordination and coordination. This doesn't introduce anything new, but I think the more examples, the better. I met him, I was impressed. Two simple sentences. Each has a big weight, 2 units. The next, I met him and I was impressed, a compound. Each again is coordinate, 2 main clauses, but now told, take them in as a single unit. Look at the difference now with, when I met him, I was impressed. Now there's a definite non-democracy in this sentence. The ruler is what? I was impressed. And when I met him just simply tells you the time that this occurred. And contrast that with, I met him, which impressed me. There, the big gun is, I met him. And a side modifier of that is, this, it impressed you, but that's not the thing you're featuring. Now you see, if you grasp the difference, these are your 4 possibilities on this content. The first 2 treat them as coordinate. And you see, you could do this first one, I met him, period, I was impressed, only in a rare context where you really want to hammer in those 2 as equal. I came, period. I saw, period. I conquered, period. I mean, if you have an utterance that is going to reverberate through the halls of history like that, okay. But normally, you must be very sparing about that. Even the second one, that needs a special context to justify treating these as coordinate. Typically, you should pick out which is more important, I met him or I was impressed, and structure your sentence accordingly. So one error is no subordination, the egalitarian method. Another and even worse error is false subordination or wrong subordination. In other words, completely reversing the logical emphasis, giving your main clause to a side issue and vice versa. Now look at number 6. Now this is a ludicrously absurd example of this error. Here the person subordinates, but in a catastrophically wrong fashion. The senator rose to his feet announcing World War III. Now there, the main emphasis goes to, he rose to his feet. And the side issue, which the structure tells you, this is dispensable, this is just an adjective telling you what kind of senator is announcing World War III. Now, anybody reading that would think this is completely flat. What the heck is wrong with it? And yet, It's not that there's a participial phrase and a main clause, it's that they're completely reversed. In this case, notice it's a participial phrase, not a clause, but it's still it's subordinated. Now look at the difference between that and rising to his feet, the senator announced World War III. Now there the structure mirrors the essential content. He announced World War III as the big gun, and rising to his feet was simply the means by which he did it, and actually it structurally is an adjective here, participial phrase. Now if you remember number 6 here, this is what you have to watch for in your own writing, where you get your two elements down, but you blurt out which comes to the one that comes to you first, and it happens that you give the main clause to something which is a side issue, and you put your writing out of focus. It loses its emphasis. The reader is kind of baffled. He's bored. He doesn't retain the message. You don't know exactly what it's after. When you find yourself reading your own writing and wondering, why somehow I'm saying what I want, but the message doesn't come out. Now, there could be many reasons, but one crucial one is that you are not subordinating correctly. You're giving your main clause to the wrong thought. Now, as another example, look at number 7. What you can do by subordinating. The student failed his exam, he became a general later. Now that's just the two units, two simple sentences. But now look what we can do. The student who failed his exam became a general later. What's the main thought that you're left with? He became a general, right? And then who failed his exam is simply a modifier. But now we reverse it. The student who later became a general failed his exam. What is now the main clause? He failed. And that he later became a general is a side issue, right? So you see the difference in weight. But now let's go on. Suppose we decide that he became a general is the main thought, the main clause. We still want to know the exact relationship between this subordinated unit. And look at here are a few of many choices. After the student failed his exam, he became a general. That's strictly a temporal relation, one thing and then another. I'm not commenting on it. Logical relationship, just one came after the other. How does that differ from, although the student failed his exam, he became a general? Now there's only one word changed, but the although tells you right away, what? Yeah, in spite of, this mitigated against it, but he was able to overcome it. So it gives you an entirely different relation than simply one thing and then another. Look at the next one. Because the student failed his exam, he became a general. Now that entirely changes it again. Now this became a precondition of becoming a general. To subordinate, in other words, you must choose the clause, you must choose the proper subordinate, and you then have to know how to subordinate. What is the exact relationship between it and the main clause? And the word that expresses that relationship is called what? The key word in subordinating that introduces the clause and tells you its relationship to the main clause is a conjunction. So we want to know something now about conjunctions. Now here's my formal definition of conjunction. I didn't give you last week. A word used to connect words and to show their relationship to each other. A word used to connect words and to show their relationship to each other. Now, a conjunction may connect single words, like blind and crazy. The and there connects just two adjectives. Or it may connect whole phrases. For instance, he was eager to go home, but not to lie down. Two phrases connected by a but. Or it may connect clauses. So a conjunction is not always the sign of a clause. But whenever you have a clause, you have a conjunction in one form or another. Now, let's just step back for one moment. Does anybody have any confusion about conjunction versus preposition? Can you tell a conjunction from a preposition? They're both little words that don't stand for things or actions, and therefore you may mix them up. So I'm going to take 1 second to read you the best definition of preposition I have heard. This is from Forster and Stedman. This is their definition of preposition. A word used with a substantive to form a phrase substantive being like a noun or a pronoun. A word used with a substantive to form a phrase and to show the relation of the substantive to another word in the sentence. A word used with a substantive to form a phrase and to show the relation of the substantive to another word in the sentence. He gives the example, he rode over the hill. Over is the preposition. It governs, as we say, the noun hill. And it establishes the relation between hill and riding. Where did he ride? Over the hill. Now, this book goes on. Distinguish carefully between prepositions and conjunctions. A conjunction is used merely to connect words. A conjunction does not have an object. A preposition does. A conjunction does not have an object. A preposition does. You say over, over the hill. Under, under the bridge. To the store. They always govern some noun or pronoun and connect it to something else in the sentence. Usually you can think of it this way. A preposition gives a spatial or temporal relationship. Usually. After, before, during, under, above, below, etc. A conjunction, on the other hand, has no object. It merely connects words, and in its most important use, connects clauses. Now, here's an example. You know, the same word, I hope that won't throw you, can be a conjunction or a preposition depending on its use. But take this one. None but the brave deserve the fair. What is but in that sentence? None but the brave deserve the fair. It's a preposition. It governs the brave. It connects brave to none. You see, and therefore it's a little word here governing a noun. As opposed to this sentence, we invited him, but he did not come. There the but does not govern any object. It's simply a connecting word, and it functions as a conjunction. Now, if that's clear, we want to focus on conjunctions. I just said this on the side. In order to distinguish a conjunction from a preposition. But we're concerned here tonight with conjunctions. Obviously, there have to be two types of conjunctions. We're here concerned with conjunctions used to connect clauses. There are those conjunctions which introduce connect clauses and show that they're of equal importance. What would you call that type of conjunction? A conjunction whose whole function is to say these two clauses are of equal importance. A coordinating conjunction. And then, of course, there is a conjunction whose function is specifically to say this clause is less important. It's a mere adjunct of the next one. And what would you call that? A subordinating conjunction. Now let's look at these in order. How many coordinating conjunctions are there in English? Well, you may be surprised to know there are only 6 in the whole of English, and they are listed in number 8. And, but, or, for, nor, yet, that's it. In all of English, those are the only words you can use to combine two clauses and keep them coordinate of equal importance. Of course, they have different meanings, and, but, etc. Notice they're all extremely short. They trip right off the tongue, and they function just as little connectives, little bridges, where the unit on each side has equal weight in the mind. Notice, by the way, that although for and because have substantially the same meaning, because is not a coordinating conjunction. In other words, when you say he did it because he wanted so-and-so, the fact of using because has the effect of stressing that the second is merely the reason for the first, and that the focus is on the first. That is a subordinating conjunction. When you say for, that is coordinating. It keeps the emphasis equal. He did it for he was angry, you see. Although the for gives the reason, it does it in a form which keeps the emphasis of the second one. And these are you know, distinctions when you want exact shades of emphasis that are worth knowing. Now, before we leave coordinating conjunctions, you should know that there's a whole group of words which function as coordinating conjunctions. These are adverbs which function as conjunctions to make compound sentences. We've seen many of them. I give you a list of them in number 9. So, therefore, hence, moreover, also, thus, still, etc. Now, typically, you use these, you have a clause, then a semicolon, and another clause with one of these, like, he came, he also ran. You see? He came, he also ran. Also, there functions as a conjunction uniting the second to the first. Why is it an adverb, also? It modifies the clause as a whole, right? It tells you, take this whole clause in relation to the preceding. But it's an adverb which conjoins, so it's a conjunctive adverb. Now notice, in all these cases, you have two main clauses whenever you use the words in number 9. I think, therefore I am. First main clause, I think. Second, I am. Two main clauses. Coordinate, a compound sentence. But the conjunction is not one of those pure first six and but. It's an adverb used as a conjunction, a conjunctive adverb. Now, there is a certain difference here why it's worth making this distinction. Even though when you use a conjunctive adverb, the two parts are still main clauses, this is like a borderline case. The second does not have the 100% full weight of the first. Look at number 10. He came and he ran. Now the and there is a pure coordinating conjunction. And therefore the two are completely equal. He came, he ran, you see. Now the second, he came, he also ran. It's the same meaning. Only, instead of using a coordinating conjunction, I used a conjunctive adverb. Also. It's an adverb because it modifies here and tells you that that whole clause is to be taken in relation to the preceding. And you notice that although he ran, in this second case, is still a main clause, an independent thought, it doesn't have the complete full dignity and weight that he came did. It's like a slight afterthought. So it's like a borderline case. So really what you have is, if you want to, you'll find cases where you want your two clauses to be exactly equal. Then you use one of the big six, depending on the logic of the relation. Or you want main clauses, but you're quite content to let the second one be a little bit of a throwaway, a little less entering the mind with equal weight. That's the situation where you use a conjunctive adverb. which is like a borderline case. It's still coordinating, but it has the aura of the beginning of an afterthought. And then, of course, you have the last situation, which is your full-fledged subordination. And that leads you to a subordinating conjunctions as instance in number 11. And those are just some examples. Now, there's all kinds of classes of subordinating conjunctions. They tell you the condition, if so and so. They tell you the time, when, before, after, while. They tell you the place, where. They make a concession, although. They give you the cause, because, since. They give you the purpose, so that, etc. There's all kinds of different subdivisions, but we don't need to go into all that complexity. A subordinating conjunction is any word which conjoins one clause to another and indicates that it's subordinate. You may use an adverb for that purpose, in which case, like where, when, why are all adverbs, but they function as conjunctions. You can use a pronoun for that purpose. Who, which, that, the book which I saw. Which stands for book, so it's a pronoun, but it conjoins one clause to the other, so it's a conjunction. You can use adverbs, pronouns, or you can have a plain, ordinary, pure conjunction, like because, which doesn't have any other function. That doesn't make any difference. A conjunction is any word, whether it has another function or not, that connects a subordinating conjunction, that connects a clause to another in a way that subordinates it. And some of the main ones are listed in number 11. Now, you cannot always simply say what the meaning of a conjunction is, because the same conjunction in different contexts can have widely different meanings. And this is also essential to expressing yourself accurately. Look at number 12. That's the same conjunction three times, a subordinating conjunction. What is the conjunction here? As. Now, what is it in the first usage? A conjunction which expresses what?
Time.
In the second, what does it express?
Cause.
In the third, what does it express? Well, it's the same as he wrote, in the manner that I expected him to. And that means manner. What part of speech is as in the third? It actually is a pronoun. He wrote in the manner which I expected him to. So it stands for implied manner.
Yes. I'm a little confused on parts of speech. I was getting the impression that conjunction was a part of speech.
Yes.
It seems like it can be several parts.
A conjunction is a part of speech, but the same word can have two functions. It can, the same word in the same usage can simultaneously modify a verb and connect a clause to another. Then it's a conjunctive adverb. Or, for instance, the book that I saw, that stands for book, it's the book I saw, so it's a pronoun, but it connects I saw to book, so it's a conjunction. It's a pronominal conjunction, if you can stand that, or just call it a conjunctive pronoun. Now, the moral of number 12 is that you have to get the right conjunction in a meaning which is clear. And ideally we'd have a whole evening just on the shadings of conjunctions. I give some on the exercises, but I'll give you just one example here. What is wrong with this use of conjunction? He expected a party and he found a fire. Now, there is simply and, uniting two elements, when in fact, logically, they have a different relationship. It's not simply a union. The second one here goes contrary to the first, right? It contradicts his expectation, and there's a specific conjunction to point that out, namely, but. And it should therefore be he expected a party, but he found a fire. Now, I give you some examples of that in the homework. I want to make a few further brief points on subordination before we leave the subject. The essence of this subject we've already covered now. You must have the right main clause, and you must express it by the right conjunction. You must express the relation by the right conjunction. Subordinating, coordinating, either a pure coordinating or a conjunctive adverb, and with the exact logical meaning that you need. That's the essence of subordination. That's what counts. Now I want to give you three additional points that are helpful in subordinating properly. And then you'll be prepared for the exercises. These are in the nature like of importance but afterthoughts. Don't confuse this with the essence. The essence is what we've covered. But these are some rules that you really should know. Do not subordinate excessively. In other words, stick so many subordinate clauses in the sentence that you lose the main thought. Because otherwise, you defeat the whole purpose. A sentence must be a unity. And you could only put in enough that the mind can take in. If you have a sentence so chock full of subordinate clauses that your mind gives up, you've defeated the purpose. Now, what to do in a case like that? There's a lot of, if you have a lot of points in one sentence, what are some obvious strategies to avoid overloading it with clauses? Because each clause puts a strain. The poor reader has to hold that and keep going till he gets to a period. And if you give him 19 clauses, he faints by the time he gets to the period. What's one strategy to prevent that? Yes. Break it up. You may say, but I want them to take it all in as one unit. That's very nice if the mind can do it. But if it can't, better to sacrifice that so that your mind can still take it in. So break it up. Make two or three sentences out of it. That's one strategy. Because each time you put a period, the poor guy breathes. He says, oh, thank God, it's over. I can start over again. If you think this is not necessary, read Kant. And you will see that in reading him, all you want out of life is that you should reach a period so that you know this thought is over and you can start again. What other strategy may you find? Yes?
Being able to simplify some of the major phrases.
You may be able to find, and we're going to discuss this next time, that you can keep the same content, but you do not need clauses for it. You may be able to take a clause and strip it down to a phrase and even a word. And if you can do that, and that's a technique we're going to study next time, you can take these unwieldy, overloaded sentences that no one can hold, keep exactly the same content, but strip them down to a brief economical expression. Or, suppose you can't. There's always one recourse which I would like to remind you of. Yes? Eliminate. Wipe it out. Just because it was in your draft doesn't mean it's written in stone and it's that crucial. Many is the time I've thought to myself, well, this point is really valuable. Only it just can't be done. It cannot get in here. There's no way. If I start a new sentence, I'm lost, you know, my unity. And I can't condense, you know, the whole thing could become like a telegram. It becomes impossible if you condense too much. So at a certain point you say, much as I cherish this little sub-thought, out. You have to be ruthless. It's always a trade-off. And if necessary, just eliminate the details. You'll also find, by the way, the more you eliminate, the clearer your thought is. Because what finally you strip it down to is the realists. Now these are different techniques which we'll have a bit of practice on, as I say, next time. When we, however, talk about overloading, there's one particular type I'd like to call to your attention. This is still within this issue of excessive subordination, and that's what's called overlapping subordination. It's kind of the most fatal kind. It's where one subordination depends on the preceding on the preceding, so you put such a strain on the crow epistemology that he just flies away and you are lost. Now, for instance, look at number 13. Read that to yourself. He was different from the other Republicans who found that he was a man who had no children who were old enough to vote. Now, to take in, he was different from the other Republicans who, and then all the rest of this modifies Republicans. So you have to keep the whole thing. But when you get to man, it was a man who. So you have to keep the man who to grasp the Republicans who. But the man who is the one who had children who. So you have to keep a who within a who within a who. And of course that's called overlapping subordination, and the mind just closes. You can't, yes. Well put, it's a lot of hooey. Right. Now this cannot be done. It's simply too much to hold, so you would have to recast it. You have to say something like, he was different from the other Republicans who found that he was a man, for instance, with no children of voting age. See? You kill off your who's because these who's are overlapping and you can't sustain it. There are different techniques of doing it. But it's very crucial not to do this, so make that as one sub-error under overloading, overlapping subordination. Not every overloading is this, like a who within a who within a who. Sometimes you just pile them on mercilessly, but this is a common and disastrous type. All right, now let's go to the second of the three points I wanted to make. The second is you must place your subordinate clause correctly, even if you don't have too many. It must be put in the right spot. English, remember, is a distributive language, and that means word order is essential. Words that are placed together are normally taken together. That's the only basic means of English syntax, since we have very few inflections. How do we know what modifies what? It's right next to the thing. Therefore, the clause is almost invariably taken in conjunction with the word that's next to it. If you take a modifier and put it in the wrong place, guess what that error of wording is called? It's called a misplaced modifier. It's a very, very common grammatical error because people don't realize how their sentences will be read. Now look at number 14. He put the ring on her finger with a smile that he had bought at Tiffany's. Now, here the adjective clause is that he had bought at Tiffany's. And by its placement, it sounds like it modifies smile. And obviously it modifies ring. And so this is a misplaced modifier. A modifier must clearly relate to the thing it modifies, whether it's adverb or adjective. And in English, that almost invariably means it has to be right smack next to the thing it modifies, which may cause you trouble in wording sometimes because it's so long it throws the rest of your sentence off. And then you have to puzzle over it, but you can't do this thing that's done in 14. Now, a particular variant of a misplaced modifier is illustrated by number 15. The man who was addressing us loudly condemned the proposal. In this case, what is misplaced? Loudly, a single adverb, And it's called squinting because you can't tell whether it's looking forward or backward. Does this mean the man who was addressing us loudly, he genuinely was addressing us loudly? And then he went on to condemn the proposal. Or the man who was addressing us in a normal tone of voice loudly condemned the proposal. You see, does the loudly modify addressing or condemned? You can't tell. That's called a squinting construction, and it's a form of a misplaced modifier. And in this case, it's considered bad form to correct it only by commas, because it's like a defective sentence which you're trying to prop up with commas. In other words, if you said, the man, comma, who was addressing us loudly, comma, condemned the proposal, you're still keeping the basic problem of the structure, only you're just trying to say by commas that loudly goes with addressing. So it would be considered better to say the man who was loudly addressing us, etc., or the man who was addressing us condemned the proposal loudly, to make clear by the actual wording what the modifier is. Now, as a general rule, with exceptions, keep words together that go together. A noun should go right next to its adjective. A subject right next to its verb. For instance, there's no justification for a sentence like this. I didn't type it out, but you can follow it, I think, simply. A dog, if you fail to discipline him, becomes a pest. There's no justification. The subject is dog, and the predicate is becomes. There's no reason to stick that whole clause in between subject and predicate. What's a much more logical and clear wording? If you fail to discipline him, a dog becomes a pest. You see, you keep subject and verb together. Now, that is not an absolute, obviously. There are many cases where you can do it. A dog that has rabies should be avoided. Now, there I have a modifying clause right after. But without some special reason, you should, as a general rule, try to keep key words together. Subject and verb, noun and adjective, verb and adverb. If you do that, you will avoid this misplaced clauses. And now, finally, I would like you to see if you can absorb the following last injunction. Use the right kind of clause. This especially pertains to use a noun clause where necessary. That's what this rule is really means, because adjectives and adverbs are not misused on this point. Now, people have a certain reluctance to use a noun clause. They think it sounds too formal. But there are problems with avoiding noun clauses. So I characterize the general rule, use the right kind of clause, but above all, use a noun clause where necessary. Look at 16. Augustine considered the essence of sin is to rebel against God. Now, what is wrong with that sentence on a common sense level? It's subject to a fatal flaw of a sentence. And you can see that simply enough. If I read this along, I read it as an unwary, but I'm in focus. Augustine considered the essence of sin, and I expect a period, right? The essence of sin is the object of considered in any sensible sober person would read it that way. So I read along, Augustine considered the essence of sin is, what in the world is is? And then I say, oh, what did I didn't grasp? That the essence of sin is not the object of considered, but the subject of is, right? Now, there is a word in English which would have let me know and have prevented that misreading. And if you write a sentence which can legitimately be misread, so that the reader in good faith gets partway through and then is suddenly slapped in the face and says, oh, I have to start over again. Because you didn't give him the tip off to the structure, which you could have. That is poor writing. You should never have to reread a properly worded sentence. And in this case, what one word would have made this crystal clear that essence is the subject of a new clause and not the object of considered? One word would have done it. Yes, at the back. That placed where? Augustine considered that. Now, when we put that in, what have we made this clause? That the essence of sin is to rebel against God. What kind of clause is this? That's a noun clause. Remember that, introducing a noun clause. It's the object of considered. He considered what? And then this is what he considered. So here we have actually worded it as a main clause, the essence of sin, etc., when it should be a noun clause. In other words, it should be that, the essence of sin. Now, it is true, and I certainly want to point this out to you, there are many cases where you can omit the that, because no misreading is involved and it's implied. For instance, if I said the following, he said he would not come. Now there, because we have he, you know that it can't be the object of said. So it has to be the subject. So you don't need the that. Although in formal writing, it still would be preferred to say he said that he would not come. But it's not wrong. But in a case like this Augustine example, without making it clear that it's a noun clause by indicating the that, you misread it. In general, you will find that there are many cases where people try to avoid noun clauses. And yet that's really required to make the structure clear. Look at 17. The reason I failed was because I didn't study. Now this is grammatically wrong. Why? What part of speech would be required after was? The reason I failed was my stupidity, laziness. What part of speech? A noun. You couldn't have an adverb after the reason I failed. You couldn't say the reason I failed was quickly. It's not grammatical to have an adverb after the verb to be. So, but what have we done here? What type of phrase of clause is because I didn't study? It's an adverb clause. And therefore, I've got an adverb in a situation where I cannot. Now, what is required? I have to make a noun clause. And how do you make a noun clause? Well, that's not a clause, then you're making a gerund out of it, but I want to keep a clause. That I didn't study. The reason I failed was that I didn't study, or the fact that I didn't study. That would make it a noun clause, and then you have a noun on each side of the verb to be, and everything is fine. Now, these are cases where you must have a noun clause. And so when I say use the right kind of clause, this is particularly use noun clauses where required. And they are often required to prevent misreading or on the other side of the verb to be, where the subject is a noun, you must have a noun. You cannot put an adverb in. So to summarize all this, you have to subordinate properly, that is by a logical means according to the content. You have to use the right conjunction, either coordinating, subordinating, or middle of the road with the exact meaning. You can't have too many subordinates. You have to place them correctly, and you have to use the right type of subordinate clause, whether noun or whichever. Now, I have one last small point. That's the main theory on subordination. But there's one question that comes up all the time in connection with conjunctions. This is not, by the way, the most earth-shaking point. I'd like to tell you on the principle of not being egalitarian when something is a crucial point and when it's a side point. But since this is constantly asked, I'm going to take a couple of minutes just to illustrate it for you. If you're too tired, tune out. The most you'll do is make some mistakes. This is the topic of like and as, and it fits in very well right here. Now, this is not a basic principle. This is a single concrete. But after all, people use concrete words, and there's a lot of interest in like and as. If you follow everything we've said so far, like and as is a breeze. Because like is, well, let's put it the other way. As is what? Now, if you say it right, you're fine. If you say it wrong, I'm going to pretend I didn't hear. What part of speech is as? As I did it. I don't need the subordinate. I just want to know the part of speech. Noun, pronoun, etc. Yes? No, it's not an adverb. He ran as doesn't say how he ran. It's a conjunction. It's a conjunction. Therefore, you know right away a conjunction can be used only when there is a noun and a verb, when there's a subject and predicate, when there is a whole clause. Right? Like, on the other hand, is a... what part of speech? Now, this is tricky. Because if I say, you are like, that's telling something about what you are like, so it's an adjective. But I always have to say, you are like Harry. So there has to be an object of that adjective. What part of speech governs an object? Preposition. So what do you think you would call a word which has some of the features of a preposition and some of an adjective? Prepositional adjective, very good. Or it could be a prepositional adverb, like, you are speeding like a maniac. You are speeding similarly to a maniac. So, the rule is very simple. You use as when a whole clause, including subject and predicate, is involved. You use like when it's simply a prepositional phrase. In other words, there's no verb. Now, look at the examples in number 18. Few have observed like you have done. Now, this is supposedly actually said by Darwin. Quoted in F, by the way, means Fowler. I'd like to give him credit if I take his example. Now, is this correct or not? The like here. No, absolutely not. Why not? Must be, few have observed as you have done. Why? You have done as a clause, subject and predicate. And therefore, a whole clause must be as, not like. How about the next? None of them talked like they belonged in a university. Now here, of course, also it's a clause, they belonged. But in English, as will not do it. There's another more complex conjunction. As if or as though, which is one conjunction. And it should be none of them talked as if they belonged in a university. Fowler, by the way, describes this usage of like for as if as vulgar and slovenly, and says it grates on English ears even in the lower classes. So that he regards that as even worse than using like for as, to use it for as if. Now look at the next one. Few men like you have been observed. Now is that okay? Yes, because there it's simply a prepositional adjective. Few men similar to you have been observed. Now finally, to give you the ins and outs of this, you see two examples there. Which is correct? You are treating me like a fool. You are treating me as a fool would. Both. Both. You are treating me like a fool. Me similarly to a fool. So it simply is a prepositional adverb. The like there. There's no verb involved. And who is the fool then? Me. In the next one, you are treating me as a fool would. Subject and predicate, a fool would. So as is correct, but who is the fool then? You are, the actor, you see. So that depends on your meaning. The general rule is when it's a clause with a subject and predicate, you use as or as if or as though. When it simply is a prepositional phrase, a modifier, you use like. Now with that, I would like you to do the homework listed as homework 2. These will be errors either in subordination or the use of conjunctions or both. And I believe we have now covered every one of them in one form or another. So there's 15 there. And then the bottom you will see an exercise in subordination. Those are 5 simple sentences about this course. Combine them into one sentence, which means you have to choose your main clause, choose your subordinates, decide on the exact relations, and then string them all together to make one unified thought. We will take up this homework and the part from number 1 that we didn't get to next time. Thanks very much.